Hey everyone, welcome back to Here in Apologetics. I'm so pumped you join us today to have Dr. Joshua Rasmussen. He's an associate professor of philosophy and his main expertise is in analytic metaphysics. He likes to talk about things about the basic categories of reality. Today we're going to be talking about some of Josh's recent work where we're looking at trying to understand the mind. So Josh, thank you so much for joining me. How you been doing?
I've been doing great. Yeah, thank you for having me. Zach, I'm so excited to talk about the nature of the mind, the nature of consciousness. I really do think this is a topic that has sort of gotten people's attention with artificial intelligence and with ChatGPT and other developments. But more than that, there's, I think, work being done behind the scenes in the sciences and in analytic philosophy that is kind of breaking out from behind the scenes. And I think you're going to see more of this in the next years and decades. So I'm just super excited to talk about this with you because I think a lot of people don't realize what's been under development and some of the insights that are coming forward now about the nature of the mind and ourselves, how we fit into reality. So yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah. And just to get started, Josh, you want to talk about, like, if people want to know about who you are, you want to talk a little bit about, like, who you are, kind of what you're doing and what kind of got you interested in thinking about topics like the nature of the mind?
I've been just curious to try to understand, like, reality. I mean, this is like just a burning curiosity. And I just continue to kind of think about what are the most fundamental elements of reality? And what explains or makes those elements what they are? And then how do those elements relate to everything else? And this is a big reason why a lot of my work has kind of focused on questions about God's existence, because God, the classical view is that God is the most foundational element of reality. If God exists, then that's going to be relevant to understanding reality at its most fundamental layer. And then thinking about consciousness, you know, this is something that I've been interested in ever since I got into philosophy in graduate school, but kind of in the background in my career, I've been kind of thinking about it, but more recently with this book, Who Are You Really? It's kind of become an obsession. It's like consciousness is sort of a window into the reality through our own self-awareness. And it's like, oh, I'm real. You know, my thoughts are real. My feelings are real. What are those? And so I've been really thinking a lot about that and researching that topic. As you mentioned, I have been teaching at Azusa Pacific University. I did share with you before the show that I got a fun update, which is that I will be moving along to Baylor University next fall. So I'm very excited about that. Get to work with just a legendary team of philosophers there. Really, I would just consider this team to be the best team in the world for me to work with today. So I'm super excited about that. And yeah, there you go. I'm a person. That's something else I always like to tell people about myself. That's important, you know, and you and I have that in common. So I think that's cool.
So let's start there, Josh. Like you mentioned, like you being a person, and like one of the things you investigate in your book is like the question of like, what does it mean to be a human? So like when you say like Josh, you're a person, what does that mean?
That's a great question. It's a deep question. And it's kind of funny. There's a little story about this, even the question, like, what does it mean to be human? Because if you read my book, Who Are You Really? And you look for the word human in the book, you will not find that word anywhere in the book. That word just does not show up in the book. So now the question you might wonder is, well, you know, why is there this question about what does it mean to be human if I don't even talk about humans in the book? And part of the answer to that, Zach, is because the publisher is trying to make my book relevant to my audience. You know, my audience consists of human beings, and the human beings want to know, who are we as humans? But I want to just let you know that my interest in writing this book was deeper than trying to understand who we are as humans. I wanted to understand who we are as beings. And so my analysis ends up applying not just to human beings, but to any beings that there could possibly be. This will include angelic beings. This will include God. You know, if assume that God is real, what is God's nature? Well, I'm going to argue that there's something about us that we can understand in terms of being a certain kind of being, that God himself also has that quality of being a certain kind of being. So to answer the question, you know, who are we really? I actually didn't have a definition that I offered in the book because I wanted it to be an open question for the readers. I mean, in a way, the whole book is designed to try to get some light on that question. Who are we? So I don't really define a person except to say that a person is whatever kind of being you and I are on some level of analysis. And then the question is, well, what kind of a being is that? You know, you could think of a person as a being that has consciousness and has a kind of personality. But then, you know, what is that? You know, and that's part of the quest of the book is to really try to understand, you know, what is it to be conscious? What is it to have a personality? So for now, I'm going to let the word person sort of just be a placeholder for whatever it is that I am. And then I assume you're the same kind of thing. So I'll call you a person as well. Anybody watching this, I would believe is also a person. Now you might wonder, you know, what about like lizards and kitty cats and stuff like, you know, aren't those conscious beings? You know, do they qualify as persons? And here I want to just go back again to kind of the main goal of my book. It's not to try to understand really who we are as humans. And it's not even really to understand who we are as persons, even though that's, you know, kind of in the title of the book, Philosopher's Inquiry into the Nature and Origin of Persons. But it really is like who we are as the kind of beings who can be centers of conscious awareness. And so this inquiry will apply to, like I said, all beings, including the kitty cats. I want to get a deeper understanding of how any being could come together and have unified consciousness.
Okay, so when we're thinking about then like me as like a human being, or like you, Josh, as a human being, or the listener as a human being, it's like we have this idea of like you are a center of consciousness. Yeah. And from that, we can kind of investigate like these different aspects of like what that means for us to like exist as these centers of consciousness.
That's it. Yeah, you got it. And I do think that, you know, cats are also centers of consciousness, right? So this does apply beyond human beings, but we start with ourselves. You know, we're human beings and we consider ourselves and we realize, oh, okay, I have a perspective. I actually have consciousness. And I don't just have this kind of undifferentiated consciousness. I have consciousness that seems to come from sort of a focal point, like me being aware of my thoughts and feelings. There's a kind of center of consciousness, if you will. So yeah, that's exactly it. So another way of thinking about this is I want to understand what is the nature of a conscious unity, okay, where it's consciousness unified in a certain way. That unification, we'll talk about that when we get to one of the challenges with constructing consciousness. But the challenge isn't just to explain how there are thoughts and feelings. It's also to explain how thoughts and feelings get sort of unified into a conscious unity, a center of consciousness, as you put it.
So Josh, I'm wondering then, like, how do you think about like there's one thing for like me as like an adult to listen to this conversation, or for maybe most listeners who are observing and understanding like what we're saying and whatnot. But maybe like centers of consciousness that maybe can't, like you mentioned, like lizards or cats, they may be conscious, but they're going to process this conversation, say they're listening to it while they're sitting on their owner's lap differently than like maybe you or I would, or maybe someone who has like a baby or a little child who maybe is processing this conversation differently than like maybe like the typical listeners. Like, how do you, like, is there a difference here? Like, how does that kind of fit in? It's just kind of thought I had as you were talking, Josh.
Yeah, I love this question. You know, I mean, if there could be like a lizard on somebody's shoulder while they're watching the show, you know, and how's that lizard experiencing the noises, right, coming from the channel? And I do think there are some important differences. So one kind of difference that I think does set us, you and I in particular, but I mean, other humans watching apart from lizards, is that one of the things is that I think we have a capacity to have a kind of higher ordered consciousness of our consciousness. So we can be aware of our own awareness. And I believe this actually lays a foundation for the possibility of language. So, you know, what is language? Well, you know, language is a way of communicating using symbols and words and devices that stand for things, right? That have meanings. Well, how do we ever come up with language in the first place? I think part of it is we become aware of not just of states of reality, but then we have the second order awareness of that first order awareness of reality so that we can then name it and talk about it. You know, so I can have like an experience of the beach, and then I can come up with some words to describe that experience. How do I do that? Well, it's because I'm not just having an awareness of the beach. I'm having an awareness of my experience of the beach, how I can label that. So that kind of like higher ordered awareness, I think, is a kind of demarcation. I'm not suggesting it's kind of like a categorical, unbridgeable demarcation between us and like every other non-human animal. But I do think it's an important salient type of difference. And it can explain why human beings, you know, we write books, we have songs, we have all sorts of mediums for communicating that we don't find that out, you know, among the lizards. The lizards aren't, you know, writing books, for example. I mean, not even dolphins, who are, you know, thought to be quite intelligent in their communications. We don't find, as far as I know, you know, like seaweed organized into books where the dolphins are like writing down their experiences, right? Conscious of their own experience, writing that down in the seaweed. You know, we don't really have evidence of that as far as I know, as far as I'm aware. so that does seem to be an important difference here between human beings and then other sorts of beings.
Yeah, that's really helpful, Josh. So maybe then like focusing on like us as persons, like what are some of the different aspects of our nature? And I know in the book you talk a lot about a lot of different aspects of this. Yes. Like what are some of these things that we see?
So in my book, I try to separate my inquiry into two parts, right? So the first part is where I'm trying to understand like what is my nature? Like what is it? And what are the aspects of me? You know, and then the second part is devoted to try to understand how something like me could exist. So what made me or how could I be made? Was I made? You know, what does that even really mean for me to come into being? How does that work? So you're talking about that first part where I'm trying to understand kind of what am I? And I've organized my investigation into different aspects that show up in consciousness. You could think of these as like contents of consciousness or elements of consciousness. And so these will include such things as feelings, like the feeling of love or the feeling of joy, thoughts, like the thought that 2 + 2 = 4, or the thought that SpaghettiOs are splashing everywhere, right? I mean, you could just have any random thoughts. So I want to know, what are those things? What are thoughts? Another aspect of you is your power to form intentions and to have purposes. And connected to that is what I would call your power of will, to actually make a difference in the world through intentional activity. I also think you have a kind of connection with a body. And so I have a whole chapter on like, what is a body? And how are you connected to your body, right? That would be like another aspect of you. I think you have a kind of intrinsic worth or value, which I try to analyze that. You've got the power to perceive. So, you know, to be aware of a sunset, that's already pretty special. You know, can Legos be aware of a sunset? How does that work exactly? And I mean conscious awareness of that sunset. There's something about that perception. So that's another aspect of consciousness. And it can show up as a content of consciousness. You know, if I have a visual experience of a sunset, that visual experience is a content of my total consciousness, right? So my total consciousness will include all these aspects, feelings, thoughts, like even my value, my intentions, my perception, my body. And then the final sort of aspect of you is kind of like the deepest aspect of you, which is like what makes you, you. And I talk about these different arrows of your perspective that kind of point deep in and you find you, the self that's sort of behind the contents of consciousness. Sort of like the sky where the birds fly. You know, you are like the sky, and then the contents of consciousness are like the birds that sort of fly into you, and you can be aware of those things. But that's perhaps like the deepest aspect of you, is like that self. And you know, we can come back to that, see how we might analyze that. But that would be a summary of some of the major aspects of you that I seek to analyze.
So maybe I'm curious then, Josh, like maybe just like get right into like this self stuff. Like, okay. I think about, like, I don't know. I just, like, I'm trying to think about, like, me, like, thinking about myself as a self. And I don't know. A lot of times, like, when I think about this, which is not as much as maybe some people do, like you, but, like, I always go back to, like, what I thought about myself as, like when I was a kid. Like, yeah. I just think about, like, as a kid, like, what was I thinking about as, like, myself as a being? And I was always, like, this, like, it was weird because I had this very strong sense of self. But then for some reason, and, like, I grew up a Christian, I was like, oh, but my conscious experience, oh, that's just the brain that produced this. Like, for some reason, like, a lot of times that was what I thought in my mind. And it's not what I believe now, but I don't know. That's kind of what I thought. But, like, what do you think, like, when we, like, analyze the nature of, like, ourself, what do you see, Josh?
So there's a lot here. And I think the brain is actually very, very important for facilitating our experiences, including our experiences of ourselves. So I'm going to say a bit more about kind of how I'm thinking of a self in a moment here, but I want to kind of connect this with what you mentioned there at the end, the idea that there's, you know, a brain that is at work and generating consciousness. Now, it's very interesting because people sort of take for granted something that is true, but they sort of take for granted that they actually have a brain, right? Like, it's like underneath this skin, there's this, you know, what is it? You know, chemical reactions in the form of axons firing. Well, I mean, there's different levels of detail. We could talk about the atoms, the chemicals. We could talk about, you know, the all the different aspects of the brain activity. I'm not consciously aware of anything going on inside of here, inside my skin. I'm not consciously aware of that. I mean, I couldn't tell you which axons are firing, or I couldn't tell you about the, you know, is it gray matter in here or is it pink? And what if this whole stuff in there is actually, like, for me, it's just yellow. You know, open this up, it's just like this yellow foam. Or maybe it's blue. Or maybe it's like a shiny orb in here. Now, look, don't get worried here. I mean, I do think I probably do have a brain in here, okay? I'm very sure of that, actually. But I'm sure of that by inference. So I believe that I have a brain because I'm aware of the scientific story of brains. I've seen some pictures on YouTube of other people's brains. And so I have a kind of an argument for the existence of my brain, okay? I mean, it's kind of funny, sort of a side note. You know, you think about these arguments for the existence of God, and one of the kind of responses to certain arguments is to kind of invite this sort of healthy skepticism about positing things beyond necessity, right? So you've got Occam's razor, you know, like, why posit supernatural forces beyond the universe if you don't even see them and you don't even need to posit them to explain your data? Well, in the same way, I mean, one could be skeptical of one's own brain, right? Like, you know, why think you have a brain? Now, I'm not skeptical that I have a brain, but the point here is that it takes a little bit of work to really understand why I believe that you actually have a brain. And I'm saying all this because I want to notice here that there's an important difference, I think, between awareness of brain activity and self-awareness. Self-awareness is something that's so familiar to us that, you know, it's like the air we breathe. That you almost just, like, aren't even aware that you are self-aware because it's so familiar. You know, you almost have to, like, notice that, oh, it's me thinking, it's me talking, it's me wondering. And you could be having a dream. I've had dreams where I looked at my face in the mirror. Well, it was a dream of a mirror, it was a dream of my face. And my face looked different. Some of my teeth were falling out. I was like, what is that? And in my dream, I was aware of my own self having an experience with my face. Okay. The point is that you don't have to be aware of your actual body, your actual physical body, to be self-aware. You can be self-aware even while you're dreaming. And I think that already says something about yourself that demarcates it from your brain, right? Because if you think about it, yourself is something that you can be sort of immediately introspectively aware of. Whereas the spatial aspects of your brain, you can't be immediately, at least, I mean, I'm not immediately introspectively aware of the spatial aspects of my brain. Now, it could be that just like a coin has both a head side and a tail side. So it could be like two sides of one coin. It could be that you have a kind of spatial brain aspect of you, and then you have a kind of self aspect of you, and these are both real parts that are connected in a unified way. So I want to just say that, I mean, nothing that I'm saying is ruling out sort of an intimate connection between yourself and your brain. But the idea here is first that you can be aware of yourself. And I talk about Hume's worry that you can't be aware of yourself. And my basic response to Hume gets worried about the idea that actually what you're aware of are these sense impressions, and there's nothing sort of left over beyond those sense impressions. So I have the sense of thinking, the sense of feeling, and there's not sort of this distinct sense of like self apart from these other impressions like of thinking or feeling. And what I want to suggest is that actually that's okay. Hume's right insofar as he's saying that you are aware of these sense impressions and there's not sort of a distinct one of just self, at least maybe not normally. Maybe there could be some kind of a meditative state where it's like contentless awareness of self. Okay. Not going to rule that out, but I would argue that your impressions of your thinking and your feeling are including your impression of yourself thinking, yourself feeling. You know, if there's a bunch of thoughts and feelings in the room, there's also you thinking, you feeling, and that there's a sense impression of you thinking, of you feeling, and that the self is a common constituent of these different self impressions. So that's kind of my first major point here about the self, is that it's something that you can be intimately aware of. You can be directly aware of yourself, and that distinguishes it, I think, from the spatial aspects of your brain. And then second, I want to say here that I'm thinking of the self as that which has your consciousness. It's the bearer of your consciousness, sort of leaving open what that is, leaving open how we might analyze it. It's the thing that has your point of view. It has your perspective. And it also unifies you as a single point of consciousness. So this is how, you know, I can have five thoughts in my mind and you can have five thoughts in your mind. But, you know, if there's 10 thoughts in the room, five of them belong to you and five of them belong to me. And the me there is referring to myself and the you is referring to yourself. So that would be kind of how I would think of the self. It's the unifier of your consciousness, the bearer of your consciousness, and that which you can be directly, intimately aware of. I would say sort of by direct conscious acquaintance of yourself. Does that make sense? What do you think about that, Zach?
Yeah, I think about it, and it does make sense to me. One thing I think about, and I've thought about this a couple times, just like through like this interview, I believe, is just like thinking about like who is like Josh Rasmussen then? Because I think about it like, okay, we're talking on this podcast, and I can see you through my computer screen. And I see like your face. And the jacket you're wearing, your wedding ring and your ears and your smile, but like none of that, like, it seems like would be like actually like totally you.
None of it's me. Yes, maybe it's part of me or it's connected to me, but yeah, it's not totally me. Absolutely right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So how do you then, like, I'm just thinking about this, like how do we see, other selves? Like, I don't know. It's just like, to me, it's like, I can't, like, you could say like, oh, I can see my phone that's like in front of me, or the wall that's in front of me that's behind this computer. But like seeing like someone else as a self, like, it seems like I can introspect and kind of think a little bit about who I am as a self, but seeing other selves, like, that's a interesting question. Yeah,
I think it's sort of by inference. It's a great question. You know, like, how do I even know that there's a self over there? Just like, it seems like there's a self over here. I think of it as sort of analogous to, how do I know that I have a brain? So I infer that I probably have a brain to sort of explain my observations of myself, right? But I don't have direct conscious awareness of my brain. My brain. And the same way, I don't have direct conscious awareness of yourself. But I have good evidence. So I would say sort of, I infer that there's a self over there. It's fallible. You know, I could be tricked, right? I mean, this is where you could have a very advanced computer that acts like it's conscious and acts like it has a first person perspective, could maybe even fool me. So, I'm doing the best I can. You know, I'm just saying probably there's a self over there. There's a self here and you resemble me in certain salient ways. And so I assume that probably there's a self over there. But I think you could be more sure of your own existence than of the existence of others in general.
Yeah, that's helpful, Josh. Maybe then just thinking about what is the value of ourselves? Like, we think about myself like as a being, someone that has a body but is more than my body. How do we think about the value of each other as selves? If we look around the world at people we know and people we don't know, how do you see value when we look at the nature of self?
I think of value as grounded. If we're talking about sort of intrinsic value, I think of it as sort of grounded in the nature of the thing. So there's something intrinsically valuable about knowing truth, perhaps. And if that's right, then that's because there's something about the nature of knowing truth. There's something about what it is to know the truth that has value. And in the same way, I would say that there's a value in just being you, and that's grounded in the nature of you, of what you are. And there's different ways one could analyze even grounding value in the nature of you. One idea is a little bit more subjectivist in its orientation, where you analyze the nature of you or the value of the nature of you in terms of the sort of way in which that quality of being would be liked or loved if it were known and for its own sake, right? So some things you might like or love for their own sake, like, for example, a certain state of peace you might like or love for its own sake. Pain, you might see value in pain, but you're not maybe just like delighting in pain just for its own sake. And so the idea here is that you have a kind of value if were you to be sort of known, you know, let's say through direct conscious awareness, like directly known, not by inference, but like directly known, there'd be an awareness of who you are, and then that would engender a kind of liking or loving for its own sake. I said it's kind of a subjectivist line. Maybe we could think of this as sort of a hybrid between the sort of objectivist view that you have value independently of whether you're loved, and the subjectivist idea is that, well, there's something about your nature such that if you were known, you know, you would be loved for your own sake. So I'm kind of playing with these different ideas as a way of kind of removing unnecessary barriers to the general idea that you have some value. And I think that's intuitive. I think, you know, we recognize that there's something wrong with just like killing little kids. Even if somebody derived pleasure from killing little kids, and let's say that they somehow put those kids unconscious so they don't even have pain, right? But it still seems like there's something troublesome about that. And I think our intuition there, the common intuition, is that what's troublesome is that there's something of value that kids carry, that robots that are unconscious don't carry. And I should say, even if the child is unconscious, the child is the kind of being that can be conscious. And that's a kind of being that just carries its own value. And so I think there is a kind of intuition that we have equal value as persons, as personal beings. And if that's right, well, then, you know, that leads to the big question, like, well, you know, how could we have equal value as personal beings when we're so unequal in our shape and our size and the color of our skin? And my answer to that is, well, it's because our value isn't grounded in our shape. It's not grounded in our size. It's not grounded in the color of our skin. It's not grounded in anything that's really contingently true about us. It's actually grounded in our core essence as beings.
So this might be a little off the track of where you were, Josh, but it's something that came to mind through your talking. One thing, like for me personally, it was always hard for me to understand, was like how to understand like who God is, and understand like how could God exist or things like this. Like these would come through my mind. Like I believed in God, but I'm like, okay, but where is God? And not like a divine hiddenness sense, but like, okay, like I see Josh right here. Okay.
Yeah.
It's like making sense of God. And one thing that like helped me to make sense was thinking about the nature of myself as me is something that is like a being that goes beyond like a material sense. How do you think, like, is there a connection here of like how we see ourselves to help us like understand maybe a little bit about how we could like see or understand who God is?
Yeah, I really think so, because, you know, think of, for example, about a dream. Have you ever had a dream where you're getting on an airplane to try to get somewhere? Have you ever had that experience trying to travel somewhere on an airplane?
I've had a dream flying around, but I can't remember being on an airplane.
Being on an airplane. Okay. So sometimes I have these dreams, like I'm getting on an airplane and I got to get somewhere. And then there's a version of the dream where the airplane kind of starts to fall apart and it's a little bit scary. But the point is it's part of the dream experience that there's location and there's places, you know, I mean, even in a flying dream, there's the sense of going up versus down. And one way to understand this is that the experience of location actually embeds within it what you might call spatial contents. So spatial contents are contents of a certain type of experience that you know even while you're dreaming. And so this is very familiar to us while we're dreaming. Now, when we're awake, we also have these experiences with spatial contents, with locations. One difference is that in the dream world, it seems like it's sort of a private mental space, if you will. Whereas when you're awake, there's a kind of like public or shared space of location. But as I've been thinking about this, and I talk about this in the book, but this is even kind of like developments even since writing the book that kind of have really grown on me. I've been very intrigued by both a philosophical case and a scientific case for the idea that spatial contents, spatial aspects, locations, those all actually occur within visual experience. So visual experience is a certain type of experience. And whether you're dreaming or whether you're awake, the spatial aspects are embedded in your visual experience. So how does this relate to you? How does this relate to God? Well, here's how I'm thinking about it. When you're wondering like, well, where is God? That's related to the question, like, where are you? Well, I would argue that actually that you are prior to location. You're the kind of being that generates experiences that have locational aspects within those experiences. So like literally, strictly speaking, you transcend location. Location is a projection out of experience. And so then, you know, same thing with a divine mind or universal consciousness. You know, this universal being, this foundational consciousness would be one that also is prior to spatial experience. And so it doesn't really make sense to ask, like, where is God in the spatial world? Or where are you in the spatial world? Unless you're kind of speaking sort of metaphorically, you know, you're basically saying that, you know, I'm going to treat you as where your body is. It's kind of like if, you know, I watch my kids play Minecraft and they'll say, I'm over here. You know, they're not even referring to their bodies outside the game. They're referring to their avatars within the game. And I would say, well, strictly speaking, you know, they're not actually over there in the game. And strictly speaking, they're not even literally where their bodies are. Strictly speaking, they don't, you know, the whole idea of location, it's really worth emphasizing this again. It's like the whole concept of location is a concept that's embedded in a certain type of consciousness. So you need the being to be conscious, and then you need the consciousness to have the type of consciousness that includes location. And that, yeah, so you don't actually have a location, except I could say you're located there, but what I mean is your body that you're in charge of is located there. And in the same way, you know, if God shows up as a person, you know, just shows up, we could say God's right there, you know, but strictly speaking, that's the body, you know, that's just a body, right? The being is prior to location. On my view, my current working at, view. Yeah.
Yeah. That's actually really interesting. That's,
And by the way, this has ramifications for like the nature of heaven, because people wonder, you know, like, where do I go when I die? Well, that's like asking, like, where do I go when I wake up from a dream? You don't go anywhere. Strictly speaking, your experience changes. Strictly speaking, even the experience of location changes. But you, the being, don't move anywhere. You know, like in near-death experiences, they talk about going through a tunnel of light, right? But all of that's an experience. It's like in a dream, you have an experience of going on an airplane or flying or something. But you're not actually literally moving. It's just your experiences are changing. And so that tunnel of light, I do think of that as kind of represent an experiential transition. So that actually the afterlife is not one that you go, you don't go to heaven. Heaven is a state of consciousness that you shift into. So that would be a ramification of this view that location is posterior to conscious experience for all beings, right? Because sometimes people think, you know, maybe God is outside location, but we are made in space. See, I actually don't think that's true. My view is that all conscious beings are fundamentally prior to spatial experience. Donald Hoffman, he makes an interesting empirical case from this in his book, Case Against Reality. And it's quite fascinating because he looks at this from multiple different angles. But he makes a case that the sort of evolution by natural selection wouldn't probably select conscious experiences that actually would correspond with something outside those conscious experiences that are sort of like isomorphic to the experience in a way that you could say, hey, you know, if your experience encodes spatial dimensions, then the reality outside the experience has spatial dimensions like that. And he has a whole bunch of interesting, going into quantum mechanics as well, talking about how the sort of spatial dimension of reality is a projection out of an underlying reality that's a deeper explanation. So combining those kind of empirical considerations with what really gets me is these kind of philosophical considerations, just from really it involves paying attention to your own consciousness and then seeing, oh, okay, there's a categorical similarity between my experience of spatial contents when I'm dreaming and then my experience of spatial contents when I'm awake. There's a categorical uniformity there, even while they're different in degree. Like, you know, you've got more control over your private experiences, less control over the shared public experiences. But these are not differences in category. These are differences in sort of the function of the experience. So all that really has convinced me that, yeah, like all beings, no conscious beings are located. Now, if that sounds weird, it's because we will talk about location for practical purposes. We talk about being located where our bodies are.
So Josh, I'm wondering then, is there anything else you want to talk about? You talked about before we did this podcast about doing, like, talking about causal exclusion, and I definitely want to get into that. But before we get into that, is there anything else about, like, the different aspects of, like, our nature that you think you'd want to bring up at this point before we get into, like, more of the origin question?
Thank you for that. Yeah, I think that's pretty much it. The only thing that maybe I would want to offer is sort of a bird's eye framing of sort of what's at stake. So you can sort of divide all the views about consciousness, like what we are as conscious beings, into three views. So one view would say that actually there is no consciousness, right? So there's no consciousness of a thought, there's no consciousness of a feeling, none of that exists. So that would be like an eliminativist view of consciousness. A second view would be a reductionist view, that there is consciousness, but what it is to be conscious just is for certain particles in space to be arranged or to function in a certain way. That'd be like a reductionist view. And so I argue against both the elimination and the reduction of consciousness in various ways, but in part from one of the arguments I was kind of sharing already, just from our own awareness of some differences between consciousness and spatial aspects. And we can be aware of the aboutness of a thought or the smell of strawberries or the feeling of what it's like to intend something without being aware in the same way of spatial aspects of reality. And I think we can sort of directly compare some of these things. So then this leads me to what I call the something more view, that there's something more to you than just material states in space. There's something else, right? And so once you get to something more view, then that opens up the question, well, how does that something more come to exist? And so that will lead us into the next section here, where we can look at the construction problem, the binding problem, and the causal exclusion problem. These are kind of big problems for understanding how a being like you could just like ever be produced.
So I'd love to talk about, Josh, specifically because you mentioned this, the causal exclusion kind of question. Yeah. Here, like, what is this idea about the origin of ourselves? What do you got going on here?
Yeah, so I was telling you before the show that I think this is kind of a recent development for me to just appreciate the I've been aware of the causal exclusion problem, but I think I've come to appreciate the sort of dialectical value of drawing attention to this problem that has not to do with how to make consciousness, but how consciousness could make a difference to the material world. How does that work? So let's say that we sort of solve this classic hard problem of how consciousness could be explained in terms of, you know, physical states. Let's say we have an answer to that. But now there's a further question about, like, well, how does the consciousness actually make a difference to the world? So just to illustrate this, and it's helpful to really illustrate this, because when you illustrate this, I think it really comes to life. You really can see what's at stake. So here I have a finger, right? And I'm going to move this finger, and I'm going to predict that I'm going to move it. Let's come up with a number. Let's do 9 times. Okay, I'm going to move it. I'm going to bend it down 9 times, just like this. Okay, that's the first time. I'm going to do 8 more. Now, Zach, I know that this finger is going to go down 8 more times within the next minute or so. I know that. How do I know that? Am I aware of the brain activity? I mean, there's chemical reactions going on in my brain, like, right now. How do I know that the chemical reactions are going to stimulate the nervous system in such a way to get that finger to go? You know, am I aware of some physical states that are storing my intention? I can't tell you that I'm aware of any of that, but I am aware of my intention. That intention occurs within my consciousness. And I have experiences with that intention that tell me that intention is powerful. In fact, here, I'm telling you, it's coming. I'm about to move this finger 8 more times. Here it goes. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And we got to do 9, right? Because that was the number. So that was 8 more times. Look, and it stopped right at 9. It didn't even continue. That's very finely tuned prediction right there. And reality matched my prediction. This is evidence of what we can call mental causation. Mind over matter. I mean, people say, oh, you can't have mind over matter. Well, I mean, I can move the matter of my own hands. How am I doing that? Is that just an illusion? Well, there's empirical evidence that there's actually something going on in consciousness that's making a difference in the material world. And the question is, how do you explain that? The reason why this is a deep challenge is because of this causal exclusion problem. The causal exclusion problem is a problem that arises if you think that the fundamental actors of reality are ultimately based in mindless physics. So you got particles or fields, quantum fields, let's say, and these are mindless states. And everything else that happens is determined by those mindless states. It's sort of like if there are some marbles rolling around and those marbles are going into different configurations, and there's no external forces that can change those marbles. But if you form the intention in your mind, let those marbles form into a heart shape, and then you watch those marbles form into a heart shape, that's going to be evidence that there's some force that's not accounted for just by the forces of the marbles and the physics. There's something else. There's some intentional power. And in the same way, if you have the power to move your finger in a certain number of ways, I think that's evidence that you are actually you have mental causation. So we could talk about the scientific case for mental causation. We've talked about the introspective case for mental causation, the philosophical case. But if you have mental causation, and if mindless states would causally exclude mental causation, then you can infer that the basic actors of reality aren't just mindless states. There's also, in addition, mental states. Mental states play a role. And I would say this is an interesting reason to think that mind is actually playing a role in the motions and movements of matter, and that the mindless matter is not prior to or more fundamental than the mental states, because otherwise the mental would be causally excluded from making a difference, or at least this is how the argument goes. And many philosophers have been moved by this argument. I mean, it's interesting. Not too many know that Frank Jackson, who's famous for his Mary argument earlier in his career, arguing that there's more to you than matter and motion. There's a sort of a consciousness that is in addition to material physical states. Later in his career, he ends up reversing his view on this, because that causal exclusion argument led him to think that your mental states don't make a difference. Mental causation is not real. It's epiphenomenal, if you will. But then later he was convinced that, no, your mental states do make a difference, but that your mental states would be causally excluded if they're a byproduct of physical states that are themselves ultimately analyzed in terms of mindless states. So what he ends up doing in his career is giving an analysis of consciousness that reduces consciousness down into the material states that are themselves based in mindless states. States of the quantum field that are fundamentally not characterized in terms of psychological states. So I think that's very interesting to me. But other philosophers go the other way. They say, you know what, actually we have independent reason against reducing consciousness to physical brain states. And we have independent reason to think that there is mental causation. We agree that there would be causal exclusion if the mindless pulls the strings. And so we infer instead that some kind of consciousness or mentality is fundamental. And here's another really key point that I didn't see this until I wrote my latest book on this, which was that it's not just that some consciousness is fundamental. It's that your consciousness that's able to make a difference has to be either fundamental or prior to the mindless material states in order to actually impact the material states from the mental. And so this is where my working hypothesis is that the way we move our bodies is that we form intentions within consciousness, and those intentions have impact at the most basic layer of physical matter. So if that basic layer is the quantum field, then I have reason to think through this causal exclusion problem, together with evidence for mental causation, that our minds are actually affecting the quantum field. And then that causes a propagation outward into the physical world. So when you form an intention, it actually makes a difference into the basic nature of matter.
Well, Josh, this has been so interesting to me. And I feel like I just have been like, it's almost like I'm peeking into like a window and thinking of consciousness, where I'm like, I'm seeing a little bit here. And I'm like, wow, there's so much in this room or in this house that I just need to explore and think about. Is there anything else, Josh, you want to share as we're coming towards the end of our time that you feel like be relevant or valuable for listeners as we begin to start to wrap up here?
I think just that the question about how we came to be is a significant question for everybody thinking about this. This isn't just something that some apologists are asking in order to sneak in their greatest arguments for God's existence. This is something that, you know, David Chalmers, a leading philosopher of mind, he coined the term hard problem of consciousness precisely because there is this challenge of understanding, like, how could a conscious being be explained in terms of physical matter? How is that possible in principle? And this is just the kind of thing that I think many different people are wrestling with from many different perspectives. And I really believe in our time, we have a unique opportunity for more people from more perspectives to come together and really to sort of seek a bigger picture of who we are. I don't think anybody really has this all figured out. I think different people have some different pieces of a larger picture. And I think we can bring together a greater picture. I would say the theme of my work in philosophy, and this definitely shows up in my latest work in consciousness, would be to discover more and more ways in which our natures are greater than I had imagined, right? Like, we're not just more complicated physically than I had imagined. We're deeper in spiritually than I had imagined. Even what it means to be a spiritual being, or the kind of being, or to use just more neutral language, to be the kind of being that has a mind that can think and feel. That kind of a thing is so profound. And I think we are often too quick to think we know who we are because we have a framework that gives us the answer. And if I can sort of leave people feeling a little more curious, you know, like there's actually just more to us. There's more to this than maybe any of our theories have fully captured. So I'm not claiming that I have the sort of grand final analysis. I offer a sketch of some, I think, important, what seemed to me to be important aspects of who we are. But there's more and more to see. And the result of my inquiry is to see that at the very least, we are very deeply rooted into reality. The only way that we could exist in principle is if we're tethered in a deep way all the way to the foundation of reality. We're not the kind of beings like a sandcastle that someone could come along and just organize sand into the form of a castle. We're deeper in. I mean, we can take different forms, but the being that takes those forms is a very, very special kind of being. And I think the more that people look at this question about who we are, the more impressed they tend to be. This is my experience talking with professional philosophers. It's like, wow, these problems don't go away on scrutiny. In fact, they sort of loom larger, and it highlights the value of, I think, who we are in a deep way. The problems loom larger on certain worldviews and maybe loom less large on other worldviews. And that's part of the quest, to sort of figure out what kind of a worldview can really make sense of, you know, the kind of beings who can have a conversation like this. So I would say those are my final remarks. I'm very glad that I could have this time with you, because I do think we tend to underestimate our value, our significance, our powers, and just the grandeur of our nature and the depth of our existence. We're deeper than the spatial structures of reality, or so I would argue.
Well, Josh, this has been so helpful, and thank you so much. There's a lot for me to think about. It's really cool to think about, like, who we are, and what has it been like for me to be Zach and you to be Josh, and for the listener to be the listener. How can people, like, follow you, connect with you, things like that, Josh?
My website, joshuallrasmussen.com. If you give a link to that, people can sort of access kind of all my projects, including my YouTube channel, Worldview Design. And they can sort of connect with free resources and my work that way.
Well, Josh, thank you so much for coming on. I always enjoy talking with you, because it feels like whenever I listen to you talk on a different podcast, or like when I'm talking with you, just like, it seems like you're always like on the edge of your thinking, and just trying to like explore different ideas with whoever you're talking with. And I just love that. And I think it's awesome. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
I'll leave a link down below to your website. This is Here in Apologetics, everyone. I encourage you to just follow Josh, listen to his stuff. Check out his website. It'll be down below. And Josh, one last time, thank you so much for coming on today. I really appreciate you and your time and everything you're doing.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And thank you, everyone, for listening. I hope you have a good one, and God bless. We'll catch you next time.